So my wife Mary and I just got back from a month in Alaska. Amazing. I love nature, and I can't believe I hadn't been there before that, because it is huge and wild and untamed. So we started out the trip in Vancouver Island and took all these boats and through the islands and got into Alaska, took boats up through there. And then we rented an RV and we drove out to the Kenai Peninsula and up to Denali. And in all of that, you don't see civilization, anything the size of this city. This isn't a huge city by lower 48 standards, but nothing. Anchorage, the biggest city, has 300,000 people. So you go for miles and miles and miles with just spruce trees lining the road. When you're out on the island, you don't see anything. I mean, maybe another boat, just islands and birds and whales and orcas and waves. So you're going along, I'm going along, and I noticed once we were kind of more up in central Alaska where there were more people, that you'd be going through miles and miles of spruce trees, and you'd see mountains and glaciers and snow patches, and then a sign would appear in the distance. And my attention just went instantly to that sign. And I thought, what is that? I mean, there is this natural world happening, these thousands of trees, all these processes, melting snow and glaciers and sun, well, there wasn't much sun, but clouds and wind and all of that. It's all happening, and my attention is going to this little square with these little squiggles on it. Why is that? What makes that more interesting than everything else that's happening? That's where I came up with the title of this talk. The title just popped into my head, Analog or Digital? Because that's a digital experience. That's an on-off, you know, yes-no. I mean, there's one way of interpreting a sign that says, Bull Moose Coffee, next exit. You know? When there's 15 spruce trees, there's many ways to interpret that. And so it just occurred to me that the practice can be seen in the same way. So actually, this is a secret way of it, just another talk on right view. But I found it helpful to kind of contemplate, well, is my practice, to what extent, it's going to be both, of course, but to what extent is my practice analog, and to what extent is it digital? So we can think of analog practice as being, I think the term in the 60s used to be going with the flow, you know? That life has a certain kind of flow to it. And to the extent that we can just allow our awareness to connect with that experience as it flows by, we might think of that as analog practice, like the hands on an analog old-fashioned clock that go round and round and round. They don't really, unless you get one of these new ones with the battery that goes click, 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 you know. But an old-fashioned one, it just moves smoothly, continuously. Time just sort of passed. Digital clocks, of course, you know, they know that it's exactly 8:14 right now. They have a yes and no. So all of a sudden it's going to not be 8:14. It's going to be 8:15 with nothing in between. There's no space in between those. We can do the same thing with our practice. Think about the insight timer. A few of you use the insight timer. You know? It's a great little tool. Great little tool. There's a bunch of versions. Some are free. Some you pay a little bit. So, I mean, when I first discovered the thing, I was ecstatic. I could choose any kind of sound of the bell that I wanted. Mm-hmm. Could set it for as long as I wanted. You know. But then they kept making upgrades. So all of a sudden, there's a social function. You know, you can send a note to your friend, thank you for meditating with me. You can know that this morning, this woman from Alcalá de Henares in Spain was meditating for 21 minutes. You know? It's really important information, right?
And you know that at the end of your sitting, you've probably meditated with 2,514
people. 514
yeah.
people.
And it'll give you the exact number.
Yeah,
you
know? Not only that, but you know that you've meditated for X number of days in a row.
Oh, yeah.
That you meditate for X number of minutes.
And you get a star.
You get a star. Milestones achieved, right? After you get 50 days in a row or 10 days in a row, you get a star. Yeah. So then all of a sudden we're measuring our practice. Rather than just doing our practice, mm-hmm. we're measuring our practice. So, I mean, I don't get me wrong, I love the Insight Timer, but there is some value in not measuring, quantifying, describing in words and numbers our experience. Mm-hmm. And as people that have done this practice for any length of time know, anything really important that happens in your practice, you can't describe in words anyway. Mm-hmm. So the thought that the concept, the view that our practice is measurable, quantifiable, and describable in words is a limitation. That's a limitation to our practice. Now, it doesn't mean that it's not helpful to measure. I mean, when we first start meditating, it might be really helpful to have a tool to kind of help us ease up from 5 minutes to maybe 10 minutes, you know, and to have that little reward when the bell goes off. But, you know, I'm finding more and more I like to use that little function, that little infinity sign at the upper right-hand corner. And it's called, I love what it says. It says, meditation, no limit. So you just set that infinity sign and then push the button and then you sit as long as you want. And when you're ready, just push the button. It'll still count the number of minutes. You know, you still get credit, don't worry. Still on your way to your milestones. But it's less digital, you know. And I'm going to be talking a lot tonight about Sayadaw Utejaniya. He's a Burmese monk that was a layperson for a long time, didn't fully ordain until he was in his 30s, but as a kid, trained with a very senior, very wise teacher named Shui U Min. And Sayadaw Utejaniya now is the teacher at the Shui U Min Meditation Center in Yangon, Burma. Or Yangon, Myanmar, which is Rangoon, Burma. And he has developed a way of teaching that emphasizes the natural flow in our practice. He calls the flow of experience and the existence of awareness nature. So I'll be talking a lot about his practice. And he recommends not using a clock. He recommends you just sit, and when you're ready to get up from sitting, watch your mind. Why are you ready to get up sitting? Are you bored? Maybe boredom needs to be explored. Maybe boredom should be investigated. Maybe we can learn something about our view toward practice by looking at boredom. Are you wanting to get on to the next thing? Well, maybe that's a habit in your life, getting on to the next thing. Maybe that's worth examining. So by leaving the practice open, by actually paying attention to our mind, our intention, before we get up from a sit, there's an intention to get up from the sit, right? We don't just get up. There's, whether we notice it or not, preceding every action, there's an intention. So in this case, you're sitting, doing whatever you're doing, practicing however you practice. All of a sudden you're deciding not to sit because the bell's not just telling you, your sit's over, get up. So you're actually given the opportunity to notice the intention to end the sit and to end the sit for whatever reason. Maybe even examine the reasons. So this way of practicing more naturally supports the overall practice of watching the mind. Mindfulness of mind, third foundation of mindfulness. And this is much more translatable to everyday life, to being able to watch our minds in everyday life. That's one of our core values in this community, is being able to apply our practice into everyday life, into family life, work life, community life. And Sayadaw Utejaneer really emphasized it. He, before he became a monk, he worked in a market, you know, selling textiles, and was very much engaged in the world, and wants for us to be engaged in the world as well. I don't exactly wasn't able to find this quote. Those of you that know his work, if you do find it, let me know. I know I've bumped into it 3 or 4 times. But he has a quote, and to some effect, and I'm just going to have to paraphrase here. He says, how long have you been meditating? 1 year? 10 years? How much of that time have you actually been aware? So what he's saying is, it doesn't really matter, you know, how many minutes you meditate every morning. It doesn't matter how many years you've been meditating in your meditation career. What matters is, are you aware? Do you remember to recognize the flavor of the present moment? If you don't, you're really not meditating. You may be sitting on the cushion, but are you really meditating if you're not aware? If you're going through your daily life without noticing anything or even remembering to be aware, does it matter if you've been meditating for 5 years or 10? Not really, because you're not bringing that skill, that practice, that that application of the practice into your daily life. And as Sayadaw says, it isn't hard to be aware. It's quite simple. You know, if I say, bring your attention to your left foot, that requires no effort at all. But to remember to be continuously aware, this continuity of mindfulness, which is really what brings insight, that's what's difficult, to continue to remember to be aware during our daily practice. So we want to cultivate anything that supports the awareness of what the attitude is in our mind, and that supports the continuity of awareness. That's what we're really after, continuity of awareness. So let's look at the digital view of practice for a little bit. There's no denying that the world we live in is increasingly digital. And, you know, these devices that we have that are so smart that allow us to have an application like the Insight Timer were invented by people who knew how to turn zeros and ones into elaborate language, into artificial intelligence that, you know, has progressed from beating us at chess to beating us at Go. So that's the reality of our lives. And I like to emphasize, because I'm a creature of habit, I like to emphasize the fact that we're all creatures of habit to some extent. Maybe some of you less than others. But we are all creatures of habit to some extent. So by being bathed, surrounded, and dependent on the digital in our lives, we become increasingly digital. We tend to see things, pick them out. Attention knows everything at once. And at the moment, you know, if I relax my gaze, if I'm not looking, but if I relax it back and I'm seeing, I can be aware of all of you right now. I can see all of you in the room if I don't actually look at one of you. I can see all of you if I relax it back. So awareness does that. Awareness is taking in everything. Now, we have filters so that we can bring our attention up. We can sort of move the slider up on certain objects so that they come to the foreground. It's a valuable skill. You know, some folks with attention deficit disorder, perhaps certain forms of autism, don't have that filter. It's all equal. It's all coming in equally. Can you imagine? Very disturbing. You know, if the sound of the train outdoors is equal to the sound of my voice, or, you know, your awareness of the person next to you. But we have this gift, most of us, of being able to actually bring up the slider on the attention on the primary object. In this practice, we call it the primary object. So in a digital world, some of that natural flow from one thing to another, in my experience, is impaired because in the digital world, things are on or off. You know, the clock is on 1 minute or the next. It's not anywhere in between. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at your old-fashioned digital watch, which I haven't worn for 9 years, since going to India where it wouldn't do any good, yeah, the analog watch with the hands. Mm-hmm. You know, you can sort of glance at it and get an idea. That's about. Do you remember in the old days when there were? Some of you might remember the old days when digital watches didn't exist. You know, you ask somebody at the time, they would never say 8:26. You know? It's about 8:30. It's good enough, right? For Eliza at that time, that was good enough. So there's this sort of on-off quality. The danger with that is that you can say, well, when I'm on the cushion, I'm meditating, and when I get up, that switch goes off. Mm-hmm. That one becomes a zero. That's not how awareness works. Awareness is always available for us. It's always at work. Now, whether we're aware that we're aware, that's something different. But awareness is always at work. Steve Armstrong has this great example. You're meditating, and all of a sudden you wake up to the fact that you're actually meditating. For a few minutes you were lost in thought, and there was this train of thought going on. Now, sometimes, like in a dream, you can just sort of grab a little thread at the very end of that train of thought. And if you can do that, you can actually follow that back. I've done it since he's recommended that practice. If you haven't done that, try it. When you are aware, once again, you're aware that you're aware, take that little thread that's still there, that little, sometimes it's just a feeling, sometimes it might be a little visual image or a sound, depending on your learning style. Take that little thread and just pull on it. See how far back you can follow that. It's amazing. So what was happening in that interim? You mm-hmm. weren't aware that you were aware, but your mind was actually knowing. So there's knowing, and then there's awareness. Okay? So that's that filter that's actually working. You know, even as we speak, you're seeing other things other than me. You're hearing other things, you know. Other thoughts are passing through your mind, right? That's okay. Pay 100% attention to your mind. Hear and understand what I'm saying. I won't take it personally. Other thoughts are going through the mind. All the sense doors are open for most of us. Most of us with healthy sense organs and a healthy mind. They're all open. They're all working. Attention has this ability to take on one thing, but it also has the ability, and we're actually hoping to train this ability to move from one thing to another without breaking the continuity. Mm-hmm. You know, the mind can move from 8:25 to 8:26 without having to flip a switch. It can just naturally just move on from one thing to the next. That's something that we want to cultivate. Why? Because right view says that every object of awareness is equally valid. The object is not important, the awareness is important. So having a good sit doesn't necessarily mean peace, calm, tranquility, and no disturbing thoughts. Having a good meditation means maintaining the awareness continuously, right through that unpleasant memory that just popped up, right through the unpleasant emotion that comes every time we have that memory, right through the chain of proliferating thoughts that always come about when we have that emotion in response to that memory. Now, why would we want to endure all of that? Didn't we all come here to get rid of our suffering? Mm-hmm. You know, we were all on some level motivated to this practice as a way of addressing our suffering. That's why the Buddha offered this teaching, so that we could know what suffering is, understand it, to know that it has a cause, to know that there is an end, there is a cessation to suffering, and to set out on the path to actually learn how to do that. That's why he offered this teaching, and that's why, to some extent, why we're all here. So why would we want to endure the unpleasant? Well, the object of meditation, the object of awareness, is to learn. It's not to be calm, it's not to be peaceful. Those will all happen. They're all what Steve Armstrong calls spiritual goodies along the path, and they're side effects, not the primary object. The primary object, primary aspiration, if you will, you know, we don't want to get too digital about setting a goal, that after we get 10 little gold stars next to our name, we're going to instantly reach something. No, that's not how it works. The aspiration is that we'll actually be liberated from these obsessive patterns, from these harming patterns, from all of the behaviors and habit patterns that have made us and the people around us miserable our entire lives. It's liberation from suffering. So, the only way to be liberated from those negative habit patterns is to come to understand them. The first task is to understand suffering. Well, how better to understand suffering than to actually be willing to be with the unpleasant? Be with that memory that we're not particularly fond with, of. Be with that emotion that always comes along with that memory. Be with those proliferating thoughts without getting lost in the content, but actually watch the process unfold so that at some level we begin to understand what is it that drives that whole process, that whole cycle in this particular example, from memory to emotion to a proliferating chain of thought. As we begin to understand that, it begins to loosen its grip, begins to just calm down a little bit. The intensity of those experiences begins to go down. The frequency begins to go down. It's by learning, not by suppressing or pushing away, but actually by learning about these processes that we develop an ability to be liberated from them. On the other hand, there is some value to being able to describe our experience to others, to a teacher, to a colleague, to be able to actually say, well, you know, this happened in my meditation the other day, or I had this little insight the other day. You know, we need to use words. The words are not adequate to completely contain the experience, because the experiences aren't containable. Their meditation, no limit. But to some extent, we need to describe these things, to share them with each other, to learn from each other. We learn both internally and externally. And the way we do that is by learning from our own experience, but also from learning from other people's experience. So the ability to actually describe to someone else. These sort of digital, if you want to frame it that black and white, these sort of digital aspects of our practice are helpful. Meditating at the same time every day. You know, when you're trying to establish a pattern, again, we're creatures of habit, that just meditating at the same time every day, you may find, is supportive to establishing a daily practice. Having a certain amount of time that you practice when you first start practicing, that's really helpful. For some of us, using labeling or noting is a helpful practice. Noting the in and out breath, or the rising and falling of the abdomen, or noting when thinking is happening, just noting thinking. You know, not as a way of suppressing it or pushing it down or detaching from it, but actually as a way of connecting with the experience. You know. So those are somewhat digital practices, but they're helpful. They're useful. So let's take a moment and just let all these words go and just kind of relax your body and your mind. Close your eyes if you find that helpful. And see what arises in response to this question. Is there a time in your practice when the digital view was helpful? Perhaps measuring, keeping time, maybe counting the breaths at certain times in your practice is helpful. Using words to describe it, either in noting or in sharing your experience with others. Has there been a time when the digital view of practice has been helpful to you? So I'd invite anyone that would care to share what they came up with, and share it with the group, and with the larger world of the internet. Anyone come up with a time when, yes?
Most of the time I set a timer because I feel like that gives me, I can just kind of relax because mm-hmm. I know I have that time just to relax. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to have to think, so I try to think of not having a time. Then I notice I get thinking or anxious or, about the time.
Sure.
You know, so it's like, okay, I have 30 minutes, 40 minutes, whatever, and then just it's relaxing in that mm-hmm. way. I mean, it helps me just to kind of know that that's what I have. And then the other digital thing that I use that is helpful is naming, like, especially anxiety, and naming the emotion anxiety, and then being able to see what are the thoughts that are connected with that emotion, and
right.
being able to name that and see how they connect it. And
right. So it helps you actually understand
mm-hmm. the thoughts
and that label.
How
yeah.
It, yeah.
Great. Thank you.
The timing does help me, has helped me in sort of establishing an inner sense of length of time, but also it's sort of what John was saying about there's freedom within that, because then when you start to get restless, you don't say to yourself, oh, end of practice, you instead go restlessness and look at that. So mm-hmm. by sort of bookending it, it helps me not cheat in terms of my own internal state and not giving up and in fact squeezing out the last moments and resisting the urge to look at the clock. I like Insight Timer. Resisting the urge to look at the clock and just wait and see
yes.
how it manifests. So I kind of the digital bookends help me.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, it's kind of the sweet thing about coming here too, right? Somebody else is worried about the time. You don't have to, you can just mm-hmm. settle into the meditation, not have to worry about that at all. Is there a hand up here?
Jim?
Yeah.
I find sometimes that counting the breaths or just the newspaper. paying attention to a feeling of movement. It sort of makes the container smaller, which I find comforting in a way, and it helps me settle. Because sometimes just the choiceless awareness when I'm sitting feels almost too big, and my I don't know, again, it's one of those things I can't really put into words, but I find that I feel more connected to that, and maybe it's a sort of the samadhi settling piece before I open up into a wider awareness. It's much more comforting sometimes to have that smaller container.
Yeah, maybe going beyond spaciousness to being spacey.
Yes.
Yeah. So there needs to be.
And sometimes it just feels too big. It feels very big.
Right.
The experiences are unfamiliar, and they can be a little unsettling. And when I need to feel more comfortable, which I have discovered in my practice is a valuable experience, I can come down and focus on just like maybe one thing.
Right. So using that as a skillful means for a while, and then opening up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You have something?
Well, I would just say that using the timer is a motivation. I mean, it's a motivation because it has the bells and whistles, you know. So it's been a motivation. It's a technique, you know. It's another technique to actually keep meditating. But something that's been pretty interesting this past year, really, is for a while I was like, really. I really wanted to know how many days in a row I meditate without missing a day. Consecutive days, you know, and this little device actually measures that. Great. Okay. Except that then, oh, wow, I'm really attached to that. So I just started kind of practicing with that and not being so attached to that. So yeah, I still use the timer. I don't look at my consecutive days very much. it's so useful in so many ways, really, to begin with, you know, and to keep going with, to me. And the other piece for me that's at some point along, I don't know how long it's been, but it just became apparent to me is like, if the bell goes off and I'm not done meditating, I don't get up, mm-hmm. you know. I just stay there anyway, and the time I probably vary the time that I meditate. It's like I just set a time, you know. I hardly even look at the amount of time, and just let it go at that. So it's been useful for that, just to kind of understand that what's my relationship to that, you know. So yes,
thank you.
Yeah. I don't know if this is digital or not. Mm-hmm. For a long time, I've use this systematic body scan, feeling the breath energy in specific parts of the body in a sequential order, and I found it really, really useful. And then sometimes if the mind settles, you know, then sometimes my practice would be to just not be directing awareness like that. Mm-hmm. But I found that starting with directing the awareness that way, with the body scan, then doing that kind of seemed to feel the breath energy moving, like flowing more freely, and then feeling it in the body all together as one unit. Mm-hmm. I feel like systematically going through, so for example, I may not be feeling much in a particular area, you know, but then having focused on it as part of a systematic search, then I feel like it gets included more in the unit, the one unit of the whole body altogether.
Sounds pretty analog to me. There's a flow to it, you know. And even though you're being systematic about moving through the body, it's done in a continuous way, right? I mean, it's like, you know, that I mean, the body has a certain mm-hmm. apparent, you know, in a relative realm, continuity to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that sounds like what I would describe as an analog process, especially, you know, you're looking at energy, body as a whole, and all of that. So, but thank you. Yeah.
I think for myself that some of the lists that we use for cultivating if we take them at face value, you know, the Four Noble Truths, the five faculties, if we take them as if each of the items on the list is a thing, that's very digital. But if we just use them as jumping off points for reflection and for actually understanding something about ourselves experientially, then it brings us beyond just a digital experience.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. And I think we've made the point here several times that, okay, you know, there's the official list, there's 12 steps to dependent origination, but it could have been 8, it could have been 16. I mean, it's just, you know, that's the way that the memory aid happened to get it written down in the canon. But very good point. Thank you. Yeah, let's don't look at those lists as, you know, digital and that's the only way they can be. Let's look at them as helpful ways of really understanding our experience. Yes?
I'm really grateful that you have this topic tonight. I've been working with the Manual of Insight, Mahasisarana.
Yep.
And in that, and every morning, I'm reminded by that instruction to really, the most important to him has been the noting. If you're not noting, you're not meditating. If you're not noting, you're not really engaging in insight. And I got it. that in fact, that's a very helpful instruction. That I have spent a lot of time noting, of course. But then a good part of my meditation had been, and still is sometimes, tranquility consciousness, just feeling this sense of, you know, really deep engagement in a tranquility state. And that obviates the necessity or wipes out thoughts, you know, mm-hmm. just sitting there. But with this pointed, systematic attention on the sixth sense doors as things arise, there's this constant kind of, and it's probably then a digital focus on an object from one of the senses, and then there's an object from the mental sense door.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And that becomes a lot more analog. You know, that throws you into a whole, potentially a whole mm-hmm. drifting into a different sense of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to come back. And part of this teaching has help me focus on the three characteristics. In each of these, you can see the impermanence, because whatever object it is, whether it's a physical, auditory, or mental object, it suddenly is there and then it's gone. And so that, I guess, would be digital, but the overall experience of it is certainly analog, and there's a kind of a seamless transition from each object to the next, but it requires a great deal of effort to keep that noting process going. So I'm experiencing both the digital and the analog, and I'm really appreciating the fact that the digital is absolutely necessary in order to keep myself in that field of insight, mm-hmm. as opposed to the field of conceptual awareness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Very clear description. Is there a hand over here?
Well, after Dave's comment, it seems so mundane.
We love the mundane.
My experience with the digital things is some days a flow is not being established in my meditation. And
sure,
so
of course.
So that's been very helpful to like count breaths for a while. Or for me, it's really helpful to notice the beginning and the end of each breath to keep me fully connected with my breath. But at some point, it just kind of goes from there. But I often present this calm exterior, but I realize I really have a very agitated neurobiology, and I need something like that repetition just to kind of calm me down most of the time when I'm starting.
So that
part helps there.
Yeah.
It was simple.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Skillful means. Let's move into the analog. Philip Moffitt, in his book Dancing with Life, says, suffering, like happiness, is a universal stream flowing through each of us. Suffering, like happiness, is a universal stream flowing through each of us. Steve Armstrong, in his Field Guide to the Mind, which was a little manual that he put together for his online course on the Abhidhamma, said, mental life, the flowing stream of consciousness, is an extremely rapid fluxing of the arising and passing away of successive moments of consciousness with attendant mental states. The fundamental understanding of the mind is that this stream of consciousness, generally speaking, carries the life force from birth to death. So we're always immersed in it. Shunryu Suzuki in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind says, and Zazen, for those of you who don't know the terminology, is meditation. So our practice is not a matter of 1 hour or 2 hours or 1 day or 1 year. If you practice Zazen with your whole body and mind, even for a moment, that is Zazen. So moment after moment, you should devote yourself to the practice. So from this point of view, awareness flows, experience flows, and to the extent we can connect our awareness with the experience, all kinds of things come up. They're pleasant, they're unpleasant, they're neutral, we don't notice them for a while, we come back, and it's all okay. Any of these objects, whether it's memory, sensation in our foot, coughing, any experience can be a valid object for awareness, and our intention is to be able to maintain that continuity of awareness, not to choose one object over the other. Mm-hmm. This is really right view. Sayadaw Tejaniya says, if we can bring both awareness and wisdom to each moment in a continuous and sustained way, then nature will take over. This will then give us the momentum to move forward with our practice, with the only effort required being a genuine interest in seeing what meditation can uncover and bring to our lives. So I love that term, uncover. It really brings out the fact that whatever kind of negative experiences we might be having, it's not about covering them up, suppressing them, pushing them away. This whole practice, you know, you've heard the analogy of the onion, that we're sort of peeling the onion constantly. We're getting down to deeper layers of ourselves through these understandings that we eventually come to in meditation. So uncovering is a good metaphor for the way this practice works when it's natural. If we can bring both awareness and wisdom, in other words, right view, we can bring both awareness and wisdom to each moment in a continuous and sustained way, then nature will take over. This will then give us the momentum to move forward with our practice, with the only effort being a genuine interest in seeing what meditation can uncover and bring to our lives. So if we could just take a moment again to let all the words go, relax, close your eyes if it's helpful. And think of the times when your practice has been analog, so to speak. when it has had a flow to it, when it has been difficult to describe in words, when it has been limitless beyond numbers, when some insight or understanding arose that completely surprised you, think about times when your practice has felt analog. Came up for you and would care to share with the group?
I'm one of those who's thrown out the timer.
Mm-hmm. And how's that working for you?
Particular time, but also I'm meditating in little pieces throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
I found I loved my insight timer, and that was before I got it. I didn't know you got stars. I would. but it, I was thinking too much about the timer. I was thinking too much about the timer. And I did what Jerry did. I for a while I was sitting, and then I felt like I wasn't finished sitting, so I just ignored the timer. And then I was thinking, I'm not sure why I'm using this timer right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that I need to be careful and not just arbitrarily say, oh, well, I'm done now. I need to be mindful of, okay, why am I stopping? Working for me.
Great. Thank you.
So I have like this sensation in my chest, and it's pretty painful. So I've been told to like open up to it, because it's hard for me to pay attention to my breath. And it just keeps, you know, dragging my attention back. So I noticed that when I have this idea of how to open up to it, like, you know, I notice it and then open up, and there's this kind of this process that I made up in my mind, like, I gotta do this. But I only really can open up to it when it's like in a natural flow, and that's just how it seems to unfold. It's not like how I pictured it in my mind. It just kind of unfolds in this process that I can't quite chart, and so that's where I'm at right now.
Great. Yeah, that's a very clear description. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, it's physical pain has the advantage of being easy to notice.
Yeah.
Has a disadvantage that sometimes when the mind goes there, it just clamps around it, can't be open to anything else. So it really sounds like that kind of back and forth experimentation that you're doing is great. Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Yeah, so much of this is trial and error, right? Whether it's physical pain or just old emotional patterns, it's just trial and error. You know what? How can we nurture ourselves so that we can stay there and at the same time be open to experience? That's a that's a balance that really takes some time to work out for each of us. Yes?
The times when the practice just moves into flow always take me by surprise. I never know when that's going to be. And it's a delight, even if it's a, even if there's pain involved, but all of a sudden, and the problem is that when it happens and I get that delight, that I'm not going to cling to it, to let it be. Just
yeah.
Let it be.
Right.
And the closest other analogies I could think of, and see, I'm probably overthinking it, but it's when you practice anything, musical instrument, whatever, and then suddenly all of the practice goes away and it's just the music.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you're walking up a dune and waiting for that ocean, and then you stand there, and then you come over it and you see it, and it's just the ocean. And it, so it's, but it's not predictable for me.
Right, sure.
And as I say, just then letting myself enjoy it, and because it does move on, then it goes back to distraction.
Sure. Great. Yeah, the challenge is really not to hold on to those. They will disappear and they will reappear. So. Yes?
I really liked your description of playing music and how it, you're still doing the same thing, but suddenly it's a completely different experience,
mm-hmm.
where you feel like you're connected to something else that's kind of true beyond yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have this as a fully formulated thought, but I've just been feeling like the word trust is like very connected to what you're describing as an analog experience. And I think it's the only times that I feel that I can get in that flow is when I can like relax enough on whatever levels are involved to feel like I'm just gonna trust what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I can also trust my place in what's happening and that I'm gonna be able to interact with it. I think that allows to get away from the like reactionary stuff,
mm-hmm.
And kind of feel the inside and outside at the same time.
Thank you. Anyone else?
There's a kind of a sense of just, again, tranquility and equanimity that emerges after really applying the attention to an object or the set of objects that come up. And so my analog experience is developing that, you know, that sense of ease, and it's tangible. Is kind of part of the fabric of the very attention that I'm applying to the object.
Right.
You know, that this is not just incidental. And it seems to be sustainable beyond the moment-to-moment awareness process of the object. So it's part of the spotlight itself that I seem to be using as a tool in the insight practice. So I'm kind of putting that together as, well, you know, this is something more reliable as an experience in the meditation. And so that's when I am able to let go of the digital and just notice a broader background of awareness that's connected with the one-pointedness.
Right. But just to be clear, the tranquility and the equanimity are effects, not causes,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it's not something you can create you don't create it.
They just
you do the practice and these result.
They happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So in that sense, they're part of the fabric. But I just wanted to clarify that it's not. We don't sit down on the cushion and say, "I'm going to create equanimity."
No.
Because then it won't. You know, then it won't happen. The very grasping will.
But it's created through the process.
That's right. It's nature.
If we follow the instruction.
That's right. That's nature.
Yeah.
Right. When the mind is calm and settled, these arise. Yeah. Thank you.
What I think what I've been noticing more in the last few months is that what I think of as my analog practice, which is being with the experience, I'm constantly noticing the unfamiliarity of what I'm experiencing,
mm-hmm.
and that the mind keeps wanting to—it's kind of stuttering because my mindfulness is strong enough that it at least often doesn't go into trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very odd to me. Increasingly, I just will watch the arising of the. Of an emotion or of a thought about it or something like that. And every time it's the experience isn't that.
Right.
That make any sense?
Yes.
It's just not that. So I just wind up sitting in the experience and I can't really necessarily even always describe it in terms of a sense door or anything. But I know that the experience is real. I just don't have a way of describing it,
right.
Just of experiencing it, and it's every time I try to say this is what this is, it's not.
That's right.
And so I'm constantly kind of like caught between the habit piece,
yeah.
I guess, or the, you know, because the habits help us negotiate the world, right? That's how you get up in the morning and put your clothes on and stuff. But this other stuff is so much more getting to be so much more tangible, and it's just odd. I mean, I have to say it's odd. It's unfamiliar.
It's unfamiliar. So
yeah.
So
that's analog.
That's a topic. That's a topic for a whole
yeah.
Dharma talk and for a whole class. Because what you're describing, the reason it's unfamiliar is that you're actually going beyond consensual reality.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about, the kind of the pieces we need to put together so we can put our clothes on in the morning and make the coffee,
right.
That's consensual reality.
Yeah.
Okay? But what you're describing is the ability to get below the concept or behind the concept, however we want to describe
whatever,
it.
Yeah.
You're getting past the concept to the actual experience.
And it's nothing like that regular stuff.
No. No, it's direct experiential. It's direct experience.
Yeah.
Of reality.
And it is quite disconcerting at times, which is why the counting my breath is helpful.
Uh-huh.
But it is. Okay, so that's the analog piece,
right.
Because then it just is what it is.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. You're actually describing the slipping in and out from consensual reality to something else.
Are you saying the word conceptual?
Consensual. We all agree that you're you and I'm me and you're over there and I'm over here.
Mm.
You know, enough to do this practice for a while, we realize that's not the ultimate reality. That's the consensual. That's, we all agree that we'll go by these rules so that we can function in the world. So it's the consensual reality. It's the reality we all sign up to. The two truths, relative and absolute. So in the relative world, you're you and you're over there, and I'm me and I'm over here, and we have our own bodies and our own minds, and we're separate. You know, an ultimate reality. We know that's not true, right? But if you try to live in that ultimate reality, you know, you're going to run stop signs and burn your eggs. So we all agree that we will follow the rules of consensual reality, but more and more in this practice, the process she's describing starts happening where we start to actually let go of that a little bit, let it loosen up a little bit, with the understanding that conceptual reality is a reality, it's what we all live in, but that there's something more. So, thank you for that. And on that rather unfamiliar note, I would just remind you to forget all this stuff about digital and analog. Keep doing your practice. I hope the for one evening looking at it in this way has been helpful, but I certainly didn't intend to reframe your practice for you. And then just try to the extent you can, to bring this into everyday life. It's really what it's all about. And in that way, we serve ourselves and the world in ways that we can't imagine. So just taking a moment to acknowledge that just as we came to this practice from a place of suffering, wanting to understand and work with our suffering, even though it might feel selfish that we pay attention to our own minds, that we are trying to learn about our habits and what makes us tick, at the same time, every moment of that effort is serving the larger world, whether that's the people immediately around us who may find a little bit more acceptance and tolerance and patience, or if it's the larger world that is the beneficiary of our intention not to harm and our intention to engage with the world and at the same time make it a better place. Just really taking a moment to acknowledge that this time we spend together in wholesome activity and meditating and in Dharma discussion serves the world in ways that we can't imagine. So may we dedicate any positive energy that we've generated here tonight to ending suffering for all beings. May all beings be peaceful and happy, safe and protected, healthy and strong. May all beings be free from suffering. Thank you for your practice.